Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi there. It's Gregor.
Hi.
Thanks for listening to So You're in Seattle. I appreciate it. I won't waste a bunch of time here, but I just wanted to give you a little insight into what's been going on recently. I decided when I started at the beginning of the year again with this podcast that I would do like 10 or 12 episodes and then take a break and then come back and do more, like seasons throughout the year. And it's been great to have a little time off. So I'm excited to talk to a bunch of new people. This episode is special because I'm on another podcast, and this is kind of the background for it. So I'll be on an episode this week. It's already out now, of the Seattle Files, a look at Seattle history with local stupid comedian types like myself. The other comedians are awesome. I'm just self-deprecating. You know how it is. And so I sat down with a dude who does a bunch of history research and then does this killer podcast. So I want you to go check that out. It's the Seattle Files. You can find it on iTunes. I'm sure Stitcher and everything else. I haven't looked, to be honest. TheSeattleFiles.com or Facebook.com, The Seattle Files. And so this is the part where I go, he's Chris Allen, and he's next.
And now, from the legendary Studio B, So You're in Seattle with Gregor.
Like a creep, I arrived at Chris's Queen Anne studio apartment, unsure of what to expect. What I found was a normal living space with one of those, like, bar-height tables right in the middle of the room. Parked atop it, a laptop, a microphone, a big stack of notes. I was there to record an episode of The Seattle Files, a podcast you should definitely download to learn more about Seattle and hear funny local people crack wise about it. It's a rad show to learn about why stuff is called stuff in Seattle and who was the most brothel-y. That's very important. Now, Chris, it was the Warren area of what is now the International District that was the most brothel-y. Is that correct?
That definitely down Pioneer Square was the most brothel-y by far.
Love it.
By far.
Good job, Pioneer Square. Way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Good to see you again.
Good to see you as well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming in, man. It's a really interesting concept. The Seattle Files is this rad podcast. I already kind of said what happens in it, but like the part that I left out there was that I walk in not knowing what we're going to talk about.
Yeah, the guests don't have any concept or any information beforehand of what the topic is going
to
be.
Yeah, so it's all on me to just react to whatever you're telling me. The problem with that is I walk in and I'm like ready to like, okay, you got to say stuff, funny stuff, dude. Come on, you got to deliver. And I found myself, like, after a while, I'm like, wait a second. I didn't listen to that one part. What's going on now? I'm so preoccupied with that. So it creates some real fun moments, I thought. And it's a rad podcast. Before we get into it, what's your background? Are you a Seattle guy? Are you from here?
I'm from Federal Way, originally.
Okay. So from the area.
Yeah, from the area. Yeah, I grew up here. I lived here pretty much my entire life. I went to college in New York for a while. But, yeah, I've lived here most of my life.
That's awesome, man. So you've seen the Seahawks be terrible and awesome.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't. The Seahawks played the worst game in the history of the NFL in 1979. I wasn't around for that. But they got -7 yards.
Oh, my God.
Over the course of the game. But I remember the Seahawks being a big joke and then going from them to being Super Bowl champions.
Yeah, them being the joke part is when I got here, but they weren't even that bad when I was here for that. I remember one time, this is pre-John Ryan, the punter had more passing yards than Hasselbeck at the first game I ever went to, and I was like, all right, well, no wonder these tickets were given to me for free.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Okay, you're also an improv guy, Jet City Improv.
Yeah.
Which came first, a love of history or improv?
Improv.
Okay.
I started out, for most of my growing up time, I had no idea what I wanted to do. And then in my mid-20s, I found improv. And I said, oh, comedy, this is exactly it. And so I joined Jet City Improv, and I've been performing with them for about 10 years now.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's great. I love it. We've got a theater up in the U District. It's a big yellow building. We do 5 shows a weekend. It's great. It's a lot of fun to do, and it's a lot of fun to watch.
Is there pay your rent money in improv at that level once you're 10 years in? Can you pay for the studio that we recorded the podcast in?
I didn't have a day job for 2 years.
Okay.
But I was not making very good money at all. My main gig for a couple of years was doing murder mysteries. I did murder mystery parties.
What did, wait, what?
You know how people have parties where they hire people to come in and pretend there was a murder that happened, and then you have an elaborate game?
What? So you played Clue for a living?
Pretty much, yeah. That was my main job for a couple of years.
Wow, I've never heard of this before. You can hire someone to stage like a murder mystery at your house?
Yes. Yeah, and that was I did about 3 or 4 of those a week.
Whoa.
And we had a space up in Snohomish County for a while that we sold tickets on Groupon for, and people would come and we would have these murder mystery parties.
Wouldn't you? My mind is blown right now, so I'm reacting. Would you be able to go to someone's place and stage one at their house if they wanted to?
We did that all the time.
Wow. So, like, give me an example of what would happen at a murder mystery party.
So we go in, we basically meet, we mingle with people in character for a while.
Yeah.
We assign people to be characters.
Okay.
And that are just regular party goers. You give them a binder of information and say, there's 3 pages of information. Don't go past the first page. Read who you are, what you're doing here, who your relationship to everyone else is. And then somebody dies. And then we say, okay, now turn the page. And then you have more information about who you are. And then you interact with the other people at the party.
Wow.
And then something else happens. And then you turn the page.
Wow.
And so that's basically the whole. And then at the end, you try to figure out who did it based on the information that you've gotten about yourself and the information that you've gotten from other people.
That's crazy. Did you write all the premises and everything?
I didn't. I worked for a company that was already preset, but then I wrote out and designed a program that we do for Jet City. So I worked for a couple of different companies that did these murder mystery parties over the years,
yeah.
And then I said, okay, I'm going to do one the way that I want to do it, basically. And I wrote out a game, and now we do that game. You can hire Jet City to do that. We'll come to your place, and we'll do a murder mystery party.
Wow. Is it ever the candlestick in the library or whatever?
Something like that. You need to figure out who did it, why they did it, and the exact sequence of events leading up to it. Whoever gets the closest wins.
Do you ever watch the show Psych?
I have not. No, I've heard about it, but I've not seen it.
I'm sorry. That's just one of the shows I watch before going to bed on Netflix because it's murder mystery every time, and it's figuring that stuff out. But it's okay. Anyways, my girlfriend, when she listens to this, will be like, that's so cool. The Jet City Improv, the fact that it could be multifaceted like that. I've never thought about creating your own game for improv before.
Yeah. We do all kinds of stuff. I mean, we do our regular shows. We do short form shows, kind of like Whose Line Is It Anyway? We do improvised plays, 90-minute full length. We're just about to remount Lost Folio, which is our improvised Shakespeare in the Park, where we do 5-act Shakespeare plays, Shakespeare style plays.
Do you have to speak in the Middle English or whatever?
Yeah. It's all, there's a bunch of techniques and exercises you can do to get yourself into that kind of metaphor speak. We also do community outreach. We teach classes at the King County Juvenile Detention Center. We do shows for kids with camps for burn victims and kids with muscular dystrophy. And we do a lot of stuff in the community, basically teaching kids communication skills, teamwork skills.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah, it's great. It's a great company. It's a great organization. I love working with them.
How competitive is the improv scene in Seattle?
If you want to do a show, you can do a show. If you want to do a show at one of the top theaters, it's very competitive.
Wow. Does everyone get along okay? Any bad blood between Unexpected and Jet City?
No, not really. Everybody pretty much gets along. There's a good-natured rivalry.
Sure.
Jet City and UP had a annual football game for the last couple of years. But yeah, everybody gets along. We do shows at each other's theaters and everybody's friends.
Wow, that's fantastic, man, because I know I've seen like a little bit of improv just at like small places like the Pocket Theater in Greenwood.
Oh, yeah.
And I've been to the show After Comedy Sports before in Fremont. And so I know there's a lot of it happening maybe on smaller scale than the UP and Jet City.
Mm-hmm.
But are those the two main?
Those have been the main theaters for the last couple of decades. And then Comedy Sports just showed up a couple of years ago, and they're the third kind of brick and mortar improv house in Seattle.
Yeah.
And then there's the Pocket Theater up in Green, which is a small 50-seat theater, and they do a lot of improv as well as sketch stuff. That's kind of the home of sketch in Seattle right now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they do a lot of sketch stuff.
Oh, tell me the difference between sketch and improv.
Oh, sketch is written.
Oh.
So at sketch, they basically just write out short scenes and then perform them. The guy that founded the Pocket Theater, Clayton Weller, is a great guy, but I think he basically created that theater because he wanted a place to do sketch.
Oh, cool.
So that's the whole idea. Yeah, yeah. But they do a lot of improv stuff there. They just opened a second space down in the International District too.
Oh wow!
So the scene is just growing. There's a lot of comedy out there.
Do you know what that space is?
It's the Slate Theater. It's in an old, oh god, I don't remember the address or what the building is. It's a historical building. I was just down there the other day, and it has the historically preserved landmark status plaque on the front of it.
That's rad. Right on. That's so cool, man. Okay, I didn't realize that there was. I mean, there's got to be more than that. There's got to be other small little fronts that do these things as well.
Oh, there's a ton of places. Yeah, there's a bunch of little shows. The Ballard Underground has a small theater that does a lot of improv shows.
Cool.
There's a eclectic theater up on Capitol Hill. There's just a ton of venues.
Is Jet City in more than just Seattle also? Is it like in Bellevue or anything? Are there multiple locations?
There's just one location for Jet City.
Okay, because I know that that can be common where like people won't want to come from the east side or something like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, okay, that's cool. Well, that's really fascinating to be able to know that there's that many there are that many options in Seattle to go get some non-scripted performance.
Yeah.
That's really cool. You've got an incredible voice. Did you ever do any broadcasting, voiceover, reading, anything like that?
I do some voiceover stuff. I try to do as much as I can.
You're friends with another guest of the show, Jacob Burgess. And
yeah.
So he's a great connection for that, too.
I
want to go back and listen to that episode now. So
oh, yeah, Jacob's the best.
So you started doing improv before you got interested in history.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Seattle Files podcast is effectively all history,
yeah.
A topic at a time.
Yeah.
What piqued your interest in doing history then?
Well, I got a job at the Seattle Underground Tour basically just as a day job. I wasn't working murder mysteries was great, but
yeah.
The problem with that was you do shows Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Yeah.
And those are all the times that you want to do the other shows that are fun and rewarding and will actually advance your career as opposed to just getting a paycheck.
Yeah.
So I wanted to get a day job, and it's just the ideal day job. And then I started learning about local history and became pretty much obsessed with it.
That's really fascinating. When you walked into Seattle Underground, I mean, do you know anything about the history you're going to be talking about when you show up, or do you have to, like, is there like a
there's 6 weeks of training.
Okay, cool. Like
when you start there, yeah. They're really, it's very competitive to get a job at the Underground Tour. I love working it. It's the best job I've ever had, really.
Oh, wow.
It's a lot of fun, but they really look more looking for good storytellers than historians.
Oh.
You can teach a good storyteller history, but you can't teach somebody how to be a good storyteller.
So then learning improv, did you become a better storyteller from learning improv?
I think so.
Were you already adept at it before you started?
I'd already been doing comedy. I'd been doing stand-up for a while, and I grew up acting, and I think I was all right at it, but
If you surround
yourself in it, and I was, when I, first couple of years I did improv, I did it 7 days a week, and then all my spare time, I would just read books about it and listen to podcasts about it and just became completely obsessed with it.
It's super fun. There's nothing more uncomfortable than being at an improv show where something's not working.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But if you can embrace that, like as an audience or as a cast member, and know that that's like part of the experience, it can be super rewarding. I feel as a I've done a class, so I'm not mm-hmm. I'm not really.
Yeah, you took a class at Unexpected Productions.
I'm not really capable to speak what it's like from stage, but as an audience member, to see it not going well can actually be sort of satisfying, because when it does go well later, it's very like.
Yeah, it's watching somebody fail at improv is you start to feel embarrassed for them, and I think that's why a lot of people think they don't like improv, because they've seen bad improv and they think, oh, that's, I don't want ever want to experience that again.
I've never been to an improv show where there wasn't at least a couple minutes that it wasn't working. Like,
yeah.
I've never been to start to end. Wow, that was fun the whole time. Like, I expect there's something so vulnerable and necessary about something like taking a risk and it doesn't work.
Have to be willing to fail.
Ah, it's so satisfying. Mm-hmm. That's okay. So, like you said, you have to be good at storytelling and getting people interested in the tour rather than just knowing the nitty-gritty details of going underground. So you transition to start doing this podcast, the Seattle Files podcast at theseattlefiles.com to find out more, or facebook.com/theseattlefiles. What's the catalyst that gets you to want to do that?
I really love history and I love comedy, and so I wanted to do something that combined both of them. And my kind of philosophy is find people that are more talented than me and then be the organized one.
Oh, wow.
Or have them be able to come in and do something without asking them to do much. Because everybody wants to do fun stuff, but nobody wants to work too hard.
Yeah.
And I'm no exception to that.
Sure.
But, so if you can just say, hey, come on over, you don't have to prepare anything, let's just hang out and talk, and I'll tell you this story, and then we'll riff on it, it's people are always willing to do that. So I can get really talented and great people to come be a part of it. And it's a lot of fun to do. And it also helps me by learning more about local history and the research to do the stories that helps me out with my day job, too.
It's crazy because the show, if you probably had 4 pages of written material ready to go about the subject that we did, which I'll just leave that so people can go listen to it and hear it. I won't say exactly what it was, but showing up and knowing that you have all that done, there's like a large commitment that goes into that on your part. Every week, how much time are you putting into every subject you do?
Every episode takes me about 8 hours total with research, recording, editing, and then the website stuff. So I try to make sure that it doesn't last more than about 8 hours per episode.
A day of work.
A day of work, yeah. I figure I can commit 1 day of work a week to that.
Oh my God.
And then I record usually about a month or 2 months in advance so that I don't have a panic attack. Episode's coming on Tuesday, on Monday night, if I don't have an episode ready to go.
Yeah, because consistency is key in this game, in this podcasting game.
Yeah.
I finally stopped beating myself up over it because there's a lot going on at a radio station, as you can imagine. And so it would be like, I bank up a bunch of them, like you're saying, and then bang them out. And if I decide that I'm not ready to get more, I just take a break.
Yeah.
And just like walk away. And that's just how this is going to have to go. That's crazy. Okay, so you spend... If I understand this, it took us about 45 minutes to record it.
Yeah.
Probably takes you another half hour, hour to edit it all.
Something like that.
Get it on the website, get it on the social media and everything. So I'm hearing about 4 or 5 hours a week that you're putting into actual researching.
Mm-hmm.
Well, where does that start? Where does the topic come from that you pick?
I ask for topics from my listeners, and people send me great stuff. People have stuff that I have never heard of and never would have found on my own, which is really interesting. The stuff about Vic Myers, who is one of my favorite local figures. He ran for mayor as a joke. He was a band leader during vaudeville, ran for mayor of Seattle completely as a joke, ran on just ridiculous, silly platforms. He dressed up like Gandhi and went to events playing the flute. He really liked it, so he ran for lieutenant governor, and he became a 4-time lieutenant governor of Washington and just did a great job at it.
That's incredible.
Yeah, so stuff like somebody sent me that. And otherwise, every time I'm researching a story, I'll find other information that's a great story. I should do a full episode about that. And then I'll start looking into it, and then everything just unfolds like an onion.
That's cool. And then like an onion, like if you plant a part of the onion, another one grows or whatever. So that's cool. Where do you get the information for it, though? I know you have like probably a lot of resources with your job and stuff like that. You probably have like learned a lot there. But where do you get the information, and how do you judge its validity, its accuracy?
I have stacks of books at home. There's also a great website called History Link, which is produced by professional historians, and it's all resource cited. It's all on local history, and that's probably my main resource. You can also access all of archived newspapers, which are all available as PDFs online through library websites. They're all archived, and maybe the best resource for validity and for just general knowledge is the 10th floor of the downtown library, the main Van Trent Library. They have the Seattle Room, and they have all the old books that are no longer in print. They've got all kinds of stuff, and the librarians there are just amazing, just absolutely incredible. I think it's a very prestigious post to get as a librarian, but they're also really bored because no one goes up there.
Sure.
So I went up there a while ago and asked, I had a really obscure question about prostitution in the 1880s. And I was like, I don't know if you're going to know this or have any idea. And they said, well, I don't know the answer to that, but I'll tell you what, I'll put a team together to do some research on it. Give me your email address and we'll send you the report. And a week later, they sent me the report on what they'd researched, what they'd found, and suggestions for further reading.
Do you send them the finished product then of the podcast and say, here, listen to this now?
I've let them know that I'm doing it, but I don't know if they listen to it or not. I'm not sure.
That's fascinating because even just thinking about my own family, I know like the gist of what happened. They emigrated, they did this, but I don't know like the details. My dad told me that he thinks my grandfather might have been the manager of the Hungarian national soccer team in the 30s. And I'm like, what? And there's no real way to like... There's not an easy way for me to go back and confirm that stuff. So because no one like you has come in and put the pieces together over time, it means that those details can fall through the cracks and possibly be lost forever,
yeah.
Which is fascinating. I mean, is this sort of like do you feel like you're doing a community service by doing this?
Uh, it's kind of become like that in a weird way. People have been very I get a lot of feedback about how people say that they become much more interested in history from listening to the podcast, and they know kind of more context about what's going on around them and where how things kind of got to where they are right now. The motto of History Link is history is a force for good. And I always really liked that, that the more you learn about the past, the better informed you are about the present.
I always think about how my history professors always reminded me that history is written by the winners.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
So if you can be a force for good, then perhaps you might even get a little bit more of both sides of the tale, which would be helpful.
And everything contradicts everything else. History is just a mess.
Yeah, I mean,
it's just a mess.
You have a bunch of blowhards all saying that their thing was the best, and then you have to figure out who to believe. I found it fascinating listening to one of your episodes. It was talking about Seattle absorbing Ballard.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the episode goes into detail about what the different kind of stances were, what the newspapers of the time,
yeah,
how they kind of leaned. Because if you don't know what the paper is it's writing about, it's easy right now for us to be the Republicans are this and the Democrats are that. We know what that is. But 70 years ago, it was a different game.
Yeah, yeah.
And so even then, if you go back to when Ballard was absorbed, what the different newspapers who had all the power because they were the voice.
They were the only media.
And so to hear, I forget what the contrasting newspaper was that was just kind of sensational, but that also would like go against the big.
Oh, the Seattle Star.
Yeah.
It was this great, just pulpy, inflammatory newspaper that's now defunct. But whenever I need a good inflammatory quote, I can always count on the Seattle Star.
Did you know any of that stuff before you went into it?
Not really. No, it's all just... Well, that's another thing I like about history is I know you are a big science geek.
Sure, yeah, no talk,
NASA
yeah.
and all that.
Yeah.
And I am too, but that requires a kind of level of either trust in the people that you're hearing it from or a great deal of pre-work to really understand science. In history, it's just stories.
Right.
It's just stories about stuff. So you don't need to really know that much going into it to really be able to appreciate hearing a story about what happened.
I feel like there's a future for either of us in helping science communicate its message to people who like stories.
I feel like
that's where a Neil deGrasse Tyson type guy, I have no idea if his science is well put not, because I don't have the building blocks to understand.
A good friend of mine did that for a while. She worked for the Seattle Science Center, and basically she would listen to scientists talk, and she would say, okay, here's how you communicate this to people who don't know anything about science.
Yeah, you got to simplify it and make it something that is tangible or concrete for human beings that are otherwise looking for a fancy story about a guy that can punch down a building.
Translate into layman's terms.
How much of the stuff that you're learning on a weekly basis actually sticks with you? How much are you taking with you when you're done with each episode?
Not a lot, to tell you the truth.
Sure.
But then I listen to the episodes. I go back and listen to them. I basically make the podcast for one person, and that's me. And if I think it's interesting, then I think that's worth doing. And then I go back and I'll listen to them. And after I've listened to it a couple of times, then it retains more.
I mean, it's called The Seattle Files with Chris Allen.
Yeah.
So it's, I mean, if it's for anybody, that's the same thing with a show like this. I think for any good show, you're not doing it for anyone other than your own experience.
Mm-hmm.
So otherwise you start compromising or something.
Yeah, and second guessing yourself and thinking, is this what other people want? And
how has it evolved? What have you learned from doing it? How much different is it from the first episode to what are you on now, like your 40th? Or
Episode 35 just came out.
Yeah, sure.
It's not terribly different, but I did spend a lot of time. I spent about 6 months developing it, and the original incarnation was I was going to do an episode on each neighborhood and then have a comedian from each neighborhood.
Oh, cool.
On, but then I realized the episode on Greenwood would be 10 minutes and the episode on Pioneer Square would be 5 hours. So that kind of changed. It was going to have a much broader scope. It was going to try to have more original, like a recontextualized. I did an episode on Shelley's leg, which Shelley Bauman was a woman who lost a leg in a Bastille Day parade accident.
Oh, no.
In Pioneer Square, a confetti cannon went off, and the confetti was doused in alcohol. So basically a big wad of wet confetti hit her in the side. She lost a leg, reached a court settlement for $300,000, and used that to open a gay disco called Shelley's Leg.
Oh, my God.
And it was the first, it had a big sign that said, Shelley's Leg is a gay bar. It was an out bar in the 1970s. Down in Pioneer Square.
Whoa.
And I forgot, what was the question? I totally got into the story and forgot what the question was.
Well, just you were just talking about the scope of how these episodes were done.
Oh, yeah. So originally, when I was first researching that episode, I had written about 15 pages about Bastille Day and the storming of the Bastille and the Stonewall riots. And I was going to try to connect these three stories. And then I ended up with 30 pages of information. That was just a mess. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to parcel it down. So a lot of it changed over the course of developing the show before the first episode was released.
Oh, wow. So a lot of forethought went into it.
Yeah. I'd been working on it for about 6 months to a year before the first episode actually came out.
Do you partner with anybody? Do you have anyone that looks over your stuff for you?
No, it's just me.
Just you in an apartment in Queen Anne
looking
at your notes.
Yep.
That's fascinating. That's a lot to take on to be able to... I don't know, without someone else to look at. I guess the comedians probably keep you in check a little bit.
Oh, they do. Yeah, people definitely give me a hard time and ride me when I'm actually telling. Yeah.
So, I guess, what's your motivation to do all this? Like, you spent 6 months without making a product. What keeps you going?
I want it to be as good as possible. And the goal kind of has always been to continue doing the show and then transform it into a television show.
Oh.
And that's always been kind of the idea in the back of my mind.
You're skipping ahead of my notes. Okay?
Oh, I'm sorry about that. Yeah.
Next time, know what's on my notes. And
okay.
Then...
I didn't look at the notes you didn't show me. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So you need to start over?
Yeah, we're just about to stop this and go back to the beginning. Okay, so the idea would be to turn it into something else to be able to make it another medium.
Yeah, yeah.
Because why not?
Yeah.
Like, I watch Sounds by the Sound, which is my buddy Andy Harms, who used to work here, and he does a show about just going through and doing music and the importance of that to the Seattle scene. Why not the actual history of the region?
Yeah, so I just actually last week filmed a mini episode to kind of have as a proof of concept and to have that set up for the crowdfunding ask to try to raise money to film a pilot. So,
oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, me and my friend Mandy, who was on the episode on the Brides of Christ sex cult, went around and we filmed an episode on Donald Trump's grandfather, who ran a brothel in Pioneer Square.
Oh, he was a real Warren, that guy.
Yeah. the building's still up. It's on the corner of 2nd and Washington, but he ran a brothel in Pioneer Square. Then he went to Monte Cristo, which is now a ghost town. So went up there and filmed, he ran a brothel up there. Then he went to the Klondike and ran two brothels up there.
Wow.
And they raised about $20,000 or made about $20,000 running these brothels and then moved to New York and used that as seed money to make real estate investments. And that's where the Trump family's money came from.
You hear that, every liberal Washington?
Yeah.
It's your fault. Your crazy sex is why the Trumps are so powerful now.
Pretty much.
That's fantastic. I mean, it's fantastic to put together those little pieces. And then it's between Bastille Day and talking about the Trump family right here, like, what are some of the episodes that you got the most caught up in that you found yourself like insatiably searching for more information?
The Brides of Christ sex cult.
The Brides of Christ sex cult.
Yeah, there was a cult in Oregon around the turn of the century that really was a fascinating. And every time I'm researching a story and I read the words, but there was no law under which they could be prosecuted, I know I've got a great story.
That's fantastic. What else is it? I mean, it doesn't even have to be that. It could be like, what's kind of the like toughest subject that you like that you couldn't find stuff on? You found to be incredibly boring or something?
Well, the probably the hardest episode to research was Harry Allen. Harry Allen was born Nell Pickerell and lived life as a man. It was a trans man who was born in 1882 in Seattle. And he lived his whole life as Harry Allen or Harry Livingston, was constantly in and out of jail, was kind of a pulp curiosity, but not a lot has been written about him other than these little snippets from newspapers. So it was a lot of going through old newspapers and trying to piece together a complete story. And it was also hard to do a comedy podcast about a really tragic life and a serious topic that is very sensitive now.
5 years ago it would have even been easier. Now there's like a lot of light on the sensitivity of the subject, which is interesting, but God, that must be impossible to navigate.
It was difficult. And I had a friend of mine who I knew was going to be very good at it. And we basically said at the beginning, like, we're going to be screwing up on pronouns and we're going to be switching back and forth between things that were written now and things that were written back then. So we want to be, you know, sensitive and supportive and go by preferred pronouns, but we were going to be switching back and forth between, you know, mentalities at the time to mentalities now. So yeah. it's going to be awkward. And well, it was awkward, but
as a culture, we're still adapting as well. We're still learning. Mm-hmm. It's like a systematic thing that you have to change to have people understand. I mean, you look today and the hashtag that I'm not even going to get into it. There's a real nasty hashtag going around today that I'm like, oh my God, like,
oh yeah,
we're taking five steps backwards. What's going on? What do you think is the Seattle person that made the biggest impact that you've studied? That's made a big impact.
I mean, going back, Henry Esler in 1852, I think is when he showed up, who brought the steam powered sawmill and completely changed the industry. That's going way back to the very beginning, but he probably had the biggest. I don't know if Seattle would be what it is today if Henry Esler hadn't brought that sawmill in 1852.
Correct me if I'm mistaken, but I think from listening to your podcast, The Seattle Files on iTunes, I think that the Esler sawmill might have been one that caught fire that caused one of the Seattle fires.
It didn't cause the fire, but it did burn down in the Great Seattle Fire.
Okay, so it was one of the casualties of it. One of the guys
that. Yeah.
1889, so that's 30 years, 40 years later, after he brought the steam-powered sawmill here.
I mean, John Bach, who started the Great Seattle Fire, also had a huge impact. Completely by accident, an illiterate immigrant who accidentally caused a glue fire in a cabinet shop and burned down the entire city. But that was one of the best things that ever happened to us, because we were able to start over and rebuild. Population of the city doubled in the year following the fire. The population growth justified having a transcontinental railroad terminus arrive in Seattle on Elliott Bay, and ended up being just a wonderful blessing in disguise.
Provided a day job for a guy that does improv.
Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah.
I guess my next was going to say, what's an event that changed the city in a huge way? That's one of them for certain.
Yeah.
I've learned a lot about that there's all these streets that we see names on.
Mm-hmm.
You go to different cities, you see different ones. There's a lot of, from a lot of the cities I've traveled to throughout the Southwest, there's a lot of common names. Lots of them are Latin origins or Mexican origins. And so you see a lot of the streets named the same way and stuff. Mm-hmm. You get up to the Pacific Northwest, it's a whole different group of people. And it's because it's all these families that immigrated out here.
The Mercers, the Dennys, the Borens.
Yeah, it's crazy to identify them as the people that settled the area. And there's like episodes for almost all of them, I think, including the one that came out this week, which I won't say because I want you to go find out when you're listening. It's the one I'm on. I'm just plugging my own appearance, okay?
Spoiler, it's the Mercers.
Oh, no. Have you covered the Denny, when they took out the Denny Hill?
I have not yet. I actually have a special episode planned for that. We're doing a live recording at Bumbershoot this year.
Oh, cool. What?
Yeah. And so that's, I normally don't tell people what the topic's going to be ahead of time, but that's what the topic is going to be for that one. We're doing a live recording on the Words and Ideas stage at Bumbershoot, and their guests are going to be John Keister from Almost Live, Kate Yeager, and David B. Williams, who wrote a book on the Denny Regrade.
How much of what you're doing with the Seattle Files podcast is fueled by the people you already know versus the ones you're meeting because of it?
Most of the people are people I already know. Most people are people I've been doing comedy with for the last 10 years or so, and that I have good long-standing relationships with. But some people I cold call and just say, hey, you want to come do this thing? I just did an episode with a comedian named Brett Hamill, who does a show at Northwest Film Forum called The Seattle Process about Seattle politics. He's a stand-up comedian.
Cool.
But he does a show on local politics, and it was like, hey, we've never met before, but I think that we do similar kind of things, so you want to come do this. There's another guy named Jim Stewart Allen, who does a lot of stand-up on history, and so I said, hey, we do similar things, you want to come check it out. But most of the people are people I've known for years.
Okay, so
they're on the show.
That's interesting. So there's obviously, like we talked about at the beginning, there's a huge community of improv people, but there's a great stand-up comedy community here. Mm-hmm. A bunch of little places that have it amongst the big names as well, which is fantastic. That's cool. Are you pretty much obsessed with Seattle then, since you started doing this?
Kind of, yeah.
I mean, having always been from here, it's hard to know anything else.
Yeah, but I don't think anybody knows. For most people, I shouldn't say anybody, but most people don't know anything about history around here. And I don't remember anything. I didn't know anything about history here until I started working at the Underground and actually doing the research for the podcast. We're such a young city. I mean, 1851 is when the first settlers got here. So people don't, I don't know. And it's always constantly new people coming in. There's not a lot of memory, it doesn't seem like. So I became obsessed with it, but I don't think a lot of people know a lot about local history.
In where I'm from, they made us take a class about the state history for 6 months in seventh grade or something like that.
Yeah.
It was like a semester of that.
We did the same thing in Pacific Northwest history in eighth grade, and I don't remember a word of it. I don't remember a single thing that they taught in that class.
It's so interesting when you have no perspective how you don't care about where you came from.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very, I don't know if it's associated to youth or to our culture, if it's one or the other.
Probably both.
Okay, well, tell us if I wanted to submit to you an idea for I want the Denny Regrade to be a podcast idea. How do I do that?
Shoot me an email at theseattlefiles@gmail.com.
Seattlefiles@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm. Again, or you can send me a message on Facebook.
Facebook.com/TheSeattleFiles?
Yep, that's the one.
That's excellent. Also, the Seattle Underground Tour, Jet City Improv. Go see an improv show.
Yeah.
They're super fun, and it's like I said, those cringe moments are the best parts. Chris, thanks so much for performing so much, but thanks so much for joining us, dude.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You've been listening to So You're in Seattle with Gregor. Follow him on Twitter at Gregor1077 and find more episodes online at 1077theend.com. So You're in Seattle is a Burrito Butt production.
Yeah, you're a good dog, Chowder.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.